May it please the court, counsel. Daniel Hillis on behalf of defendant appellant Keith Jordan. Before beginning my argument, I note the issue that I'm arguing here today has also been raised in a pending case, United States versus Pritchard, case number 132646.
Thank you.
If there are no questions as to the standard of review, I'd like to move on to the basic issue in this case, in which is as follows. During the revocation hearing, the district court erred by abridging the defendant's right to confront an adverse witness. As a matter of due process, that's problematic because the district court made no finding that the government's evidence was reliable. And in fact, the evidence was not reliable because there was, contrary to the government's statement in its brief, no admission by Mr. Jordan about the presence of marijuana. He merely questioned what he would be charged with. And also, there was no lab report establishing the nature or substance of any marijuana, no report as to its weight other than the police report. The evidence consisted largely of a police report in this case. There were only investigative materials prepared by the police officer, and he was the witness who did not testify. Police reports are, in fact, adversarial in nature. They are not inherently reliable. They are proof only of an arrest, and that's all we had in this case. We should have had a witness come forward to testify about the items contained in the report. The report was not made under oath. There is no particular indicia of reliability. So vacating and remanding would be appropriate under this court's Kelly opinion.
Did you contest that the videotape was substantially trustworthy?
Your Honor, we did not contest the videotape other than we sought to bar its admission because it seemed inflammatory to us, and we
It
agreed.
Seemed what? Inflammatory?
Inflammatory. There was a high-speed chase, and there were matters going on that we did not want imputed to Mr. Jordan.
He wasn't in the car at the time of the chase, was he?
He was put in handcuffs in the car.
He was in the police. Oh, he was in the back of the police car that was making the chase?
Yes, sir. He was in the front seat of the police car in cuffs while there was a 100-mile-per-hour chase, and the police were shooting at a fleeing vehicle. So we were not in particular interest of having that video shown.
But how could it be inflammatory? It's before a judge. I mean, a judge is going to be able to separate what's relevant and what's not.
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, though, to avoid those sort of things and that evidence being presented, we were willing to stipulate, and the government did not make any arguments about the flight and so forth and the dangerousness of it and how that might be imputed to Mr. Jordan, which I believe that it shouldn't, but the government in its brief is in fact making those exact arguments here, and we sought to forestall that by agreeing and stipulating that Mr. Jordan was out of the jurisdiction in Texas and therefore, having done so, committed a grade C violation. We would have stipulated to that, and we did offer to do so. That, however, is just the due process part. And while that due process part, we believe, warrants a remand and a vacating in this case, there's also the matter of the Rule 32.1b2c issue. And Kelly does not address that, and so we don't believe that Kelly has to be reversed. But we are concerned that that rule was not applied here. And that rule, in conjunction with the 2002 committee notes, requires a balancing test be used to determine whether to allow confrontation. The balancing test, as employed in the Eighth Circuit's case, United States versus Johnson, requires a district court to assess the government's explanation of why confrontation is undesirable or impractical. And in this case, the government simply said, the witness isn't here because we didn't call him. That's troublesome.
In that balancing test, I mean, do we get a different result if we're talking about an Indiana state trooper, a Texas state trooper, an Alaska state trooper, a foreign police officer? Does any of that affect the reliability of the evidence or the fairness of its use?
I don't know that it affects the reliability of the evidence. It would bear on the government's explanation for why the witness wasn't tendered. And, of course, there are alternates that could have been sought in this case. The government could have sought to produce the witness's testimony by telephone or video. Didn't do so in this case. It simply said it didn't need to because the rules of evidence didn't require it despite our due process concerns and despite Rule 32.1.
Mr. Hillis, was the Rule 32.1 issue brought to the attention of the district court?
It was not.
Is that a problem?
I don't believe so. United States versus Johnson states that the issue, I don't believe, was advance there either, and it was not contested when we argued and relied on Johnson in our opening brief that that opened the door and allowed us to rely on Rule 32.1b2c here. The government didn't make any argument to the contrary. I think the decision in Johnson supports our position here. And district courts are presumed to know the rules, and that would be the case as well.
Let me ask you, Mr. Hillis, what would you have asked Trooper Wilson if he was in court?
There are two people in the car. Whose drugs are they? Whose might they be? How do you know that it's marijuana? Where's the test? Where's the lab report? Where's the weighing? All of these things. What's your experience? There are a number of questions that we could have asked the witness had he been there.
But those are things, I mean, you didn't have to ask him. You knew those things. You knew that those problems were there. You could have made those comments, whether Wilson testified or not.
We made some of those statements to the court. We asked what is if the probation officer who talked to the officer, if he knew anything about the officer. Yes, sir.
All right, let me ask you just two more quick things. Do you contest that if the police report and videotape were properly admitted, and I understand that you don't, would that be enough to establish distribution by preponderance of the evidence? Just hypothetically, if they were.
Hypothetically, the district court, I believe, could make a decision that based on the quantity and the proximity, that under a preponderance standard, that could be satisfied.
All right. Well, let me ask you one more thing then. Why didn't, if you anticipated there was some problem with the police report or there was some problem with the videotape, why didn't you subpoena the trooper into court?
I don't have a particular interest in bringing an adverse witness to say bad things about my client. And if
You're bringing a witness in to say that there's problems with the state's evidence.
It was the government's burden to establish my client's violation, and I believe that bringing in the witness, subpoenaing the witness in the past practice in the cases that I reviewed would be on the government to bring in that witness. I had an absence of evidence that I was attempting to rely on to make my argument, and the government it was incumbent on them to bring in the police officer, since it's not been the case that
It wasn't an absence of evidence, though. It was an infirmity in the evidence, and that's why I'm saying there was a way open to you to bring somebody into court to show what was weak about that evidence.
I disagree insofar as an infirmity, Your Honor. And I'll be brief because my light is on. I don't want to go too far into my rebuttal time. But the police reports could not be admitted and relied upon by themselves. A witness was necessary. The government didn't have that witness there. I was capable of arguing the case and its defect without the witness, and the court, absent the witness, would not be able to rely on the proffered evidence as far as the police report, and that would then have led us to a grade C violation, which my client was willing to admit to, and we hope that would have been the limit of his criminal exposure.
Thank you, Mr. Hillis. Ms. Mullen.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel Linda Mullen on behalf of the United States. I think the parties agree here that the question in this appeal is a narrow one. And so that question is whether the district court properly relied upon Trooper Wilson's report to find that the defendant possessed a distributable amount of marijuana, right? Because the defendant acknowledges that he was in Texas. He acknowledges he was with a known felon. He acknowledges that he was arrested. And, of course, he acknowledges those things because we have an audio-video recording that shows that he was there and corroborates to a large extent this incredibly detailed, thorough police report. If you've had a chance to look at the report, and surely you've read the brief so that you know what it says, it's one of the most detailed, thorough police reports I've actually ever seen. It goes into great detail, second by second, minute by minute of this stop. So the question is, was that reliable for the district court to consider that? Was that substantially trustworthy? And we look at the record as a whole to determine that. So we have not just the police report that on its face is detailed. We have the corroboration from the audio videotape. We have the Texas State, Judge Hamilton.
Good.
Okay. We have the Texas State Court indictment. And we do have language from the defendant. The video speaks for itself. We don't need to quibble about what he might have meant or didn't mean, but he did say in the video, and you can hear it, we cite to the particular hour and second, he did say, so is this a felony? the officer that was with him at the time, not the officer that pulled him over initially, said, I'm not sure what he's going to charge you with. The defendant says, well, it's marijuana, that's what's in the car, whatever. So we have all of that in terms of establishing reliability. I think the panel has pointed out that this evidence on its face is essentially reliable. So the question is, can the defense bring forth something to challenge that reliability?
What rule are you suggesting we apply here, that police reports can be used to revoke supervised release?
Reliable police reports. And I think that that's what this court has said time and time again. We're not suggesting that all hearsay is admissible. We're following the authority from this court that
I'm troubled. The transcript here does not indicate that kind of subtlety. We've got a prosecutor saying, I didn't call him because I don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
No explanation, no argument, no consideration by the district judge of whether this is reliable. No finding under Rule 32.1 about the interests of justice, and no finding of reliability. That troubles me very much.
Those are all fair questions, Judge Hamilton, so let's look at that. I think that, you know, it's an unfortunate comment that the prosecutor made in saying, I didn't call the witness because I didn't have to, because I don't think that it appropriately focused the inquiry here. The court was faced with essentially the same issue in Kelly, where the prosecutor said the same thing. The rules of evidence don't apply. Hearsay is admissible, and that doesn't appropriately focus the court. That doesn't mean that the court wasn't focused, however. Defense counsel did raise the issue of reliability in objecting to the evidence. I think it's implicit in the court's findings that the court, in light of that objection,
Why isn't it equally implicit? Just as fair an inference that the district judge accepted the prosecutor's argument.
Well, let's assume that that's true, just for the sake of argument. I we don't know what the district judge was thinking, and we don't have an explicit finding with respect to reliability. As this court said in Kelly, and as we point out in our brief, that's not really unduly problematic here. We would certainly prefer that the parties appropriately focus the issue. We would certainly prefer that a judge make explicit reliability findings on the record. That didn't happen here. But this court is perfectly well positioned to look at the evidence that was admitted here, to look at the police report in the context of the audio-video recording, the testimony of the probation officer, the Texas State Court indictment, and make an independent determination about whether or not the record supports a reliability finding here.
So we're supposed to make that finding?
You're not supposed to make that finding in the first instance. I mean, ideally, the district court would have made that finding on the record, and that's what this court said in Kelly, that the district court should be making that finding on the record. That didn't happen here. And so the question here, let's assume that's error, not to make the explicit finding on the record, is whether or not it was harmless error. So, Judge Hamilton, what we're saying is when you have this record, we think it's a very strong record in terms of supporting the reliability of this evidence in this case. I mean, the issue is very narrow, and that is, this is an issue of an identity which is presented
My concern, Ms. Mullen, frankly, is that it's starting to look like there's a pattern here with prosecutors bluffing district judges into thinking that anything can come in a supervised release hearing.
Oh, I certainly hope that's not the case. And my opponent referenced another case. I think he called it Pritchard. I'm familiar with another case in front of the court right now that where I wrote the brief. It's essentially the companion case to this case, Wallace. Robert,
the driver of the car.
The passenger turned driver of the car.
That evidence may be a little better.
Mr. Wallace. Okay, so you have the same district court prosecutor below, Mr. Bass, a very experienced prosecutor. Mr. Jordan's revocation hearing was held first, then Mr. Wallace's. By the time they got to Mr. Wallace's hearing, which I think was a month or two later, the parties actually filed position statements prior to the hearing. We set this forth in a footnote in our brief, but filed position statements about the reliability of the evidence and asking the court to review the evidence and make a specific finding. So I don't think, you know, I can't speak to the cases that this court sees overall, but I can tell you with respect to our office and this particular prosecutor, who is a very seasoned, experienced, earnest prosecutor, if there was a mistake made in terms of what he said at the Jordan hearing or didn't say, that was fully corrected by the Wallace hearing a month later, where the parties filed these position statements and set forth the standard and made the argument to the district court different judge prior to the hearing. So, and we had the same police report being admitted in that case without the trooper testifying and a court making a specific interest of justice finding in that case. So I don't think that that is an ongoing problem. Again, is it a helpful fact for us that the prosecutor maybe sort of glibly said, I didn't call the witness because I didn't have to? No, that atmospherically is not good for us. It's something that I wish that he hadn't said. I think that he was focused at the time on all of the discussion that was being had about hearsay evidence and reminding the court that hearsay was admissible and didn't go the extra step of saying we have to look at the reliability. But again, on this record, I don't think that that's particularly problematic.
Let me ask you, if we were to use a balancing test, what would the government argue was good cause for denying Mr. Jordan his right to confront this adverse witness?
I think that's such a good question, because I think that whether we're talking about a balancing test that's explicit or implicit, or we all end up at the same place, which is reliability. And I think that although the prosecutor, again, in the other case, did say there's obvious time and expense involved in bringing an out-of-state witness to Illinois, I think
But not in this case, because the prosecutor said we wouldn't have had any problem bringing him into Illinois.
Well, he said we would have brought him in. I don't know. That doesn't mean that the same expense isn't associated with it. I think the court can almost take judicial notice of the fact that there's expense involved in bringing a witness from out of state. But I think at the end of the day, it's the prosecutor's very strongly held view that the evidence is reliable here, and they end up the good cause and the reliability of the evidence sort of collapse into one another. And so in every case, the government is put in a position of making reasoned judgments about how many witnesses to call and whether to bring in witnesses from out of state. And we have to be, especially in these times of, you know, substantial budget constraints, we have to be good stewards of the public fisc as well. And I think that it was his view that this wasn't even close, that on this particular record, it wasn't necessary. And so part of the good cause would be the reliability and the substantial trustworthiness of the evidence that was presented. If the court has no more questions, I will return the balance of my time. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Ms. Mellon.
Your Honor, I'll begin last with the prosecutor, with the government's last point. In times of fiscal constraint, it is not very expensive to pick up a telephone and try to have an officer present by phone or by video, and Judge Myerscough's courtroom is equipped for both. As far as reliability, the probation officer testified, as the government mentioned, but the probation officer testified about what the trooper told the probation officer. We need to strip away all the various incarnations of the government's evidence, and it all comes back to a police report, and police reports are not inherently reliable. And I think that we should be very careful to trot down a path where we can now dispense with the necessity of allowing a defendant the right to confront an adverse witness, because we don't know what might be said upon cross-examination. We don't know what might be ferreted out. And to simply say in the first instance that a police report, when it's detailed, seems like it's enough, that's troublesome. That's not consistent with the rule, Rule 32.1.
What would be your suggestion of what ought to be required of producing an adverse witness? Case by case? What would, Mr. Hillis, your approach be?
Yes. Well, I think case by case is the method, Your Honor. There's post-Morrissey. There were numerous things that were mentioned in that decision about what type of evidence may be reliable, and I think it's incumbent on the district court to look through the type of evidence that's being proffered and to make a determination. And there was no determination in this case about any reliable evidence.
Because if you get too close to an absolute requirement, that might not always in order to the benefit of the defendant, right?
It may not.
Might not in this case. I mean, the sentence in this case might have been different. Even.
Your Honor, you received the maximum.
Yeah, no, I understand.
And
you wouldn't suggest in this case it would have been less if Wilson was there.
Depending on what would have come out in cross-examination by way of any statement that the officer may have said about whose marijuana it was, one person having fled, one person did not, things of that nature could have impacted the sentence.
Would you say there was no balancing in this case?
Your Honor, there are no findings, and no, there's no balancing.
But if a district judge is presented with the report and presumably is going over it, isn't that initiating some kind of balancing test to start with in a probationary, in a, you know, revocation situation?
Your Honor, I don't believe that that can be so, and I'd be troubled still by the lack of findings as to that, even if it were so. And, of course, if the district court is to do that and the defense doesn't have an opportunity to try to illustrate what the deficiencies in the report may be, then we are basically on the outside looking in for all purposes, and the rule should be to allow confrontation.
If you're going to challenge the report's sufficiency, will you always have to have the underlying witnesses? Will it always be incomplete, Mr. Hillis, is what I'm asking. If you cannot have a district judge contrast those voices that went into the report being heard before him or her at the hearing.
Your Honor, I believe that, yes, an officer who authors the report always has to be present to be cross-examined about the contents of that report. Congress has not allowed, there's been nothing in the rules of evidence that suggests a police report can be relied upon by itself. I don't think that that should be the case in revocations or in a criminal trial.
How about a lab report? Would you relax the standard for supervised release revocations compared to trials?
A lab report presents a different issue, and the one case that comes to mind on that is, I believe it's the First Circuit's case, and in that case, there was the failure of the chemist to actually come in, which raised then questions about the lab report. So, in general, a lab report has stronger indicia of reliability.
One quick question. What happened to Keith down in Texas?
I beg your pardon, Mr.
What happened to Mr. Jordan down in Texas?
The matter is still pending, last I knew.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hillis. Thank you, Ms. Mullen. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand.